From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
And so, after a while, some people began to believe that they came over here on the Mayflower. That they were part of the pilgrims. That they didn't come over here across the dreaded Middle Passage. That somehow their experience, their attitudes, their ideas were not really African.
He coined the term Afrocentricity. Professor Malefe Asante speaks out on Eurocentric history and challenges some of the assumptions that guide U.S. public education. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. This week, a federal judge in California has overturned a 1982 state law that allowed police officers to sue individuals who complained of police misconduct. U.S. District Judge Gary L. Taylor ruled on Wednesday that the law violated constitutional rights to free speech. The American Civil Liberties Union challenged the law, saying officers had been using to prevent people from following through with complaints. Today, we're going to take a look at these protests against police brutality. The ACLU filed the suit on behalf of Myron Grichen, who was stopped in April 1998 by a Long Beach police officer and accused of speeding. Grichen, who denied the charge, filed a complaint against the officer and 2 months later received a letter from the officer's attorney threatening to sue him. Today is October 22nd, and a broad coalition led by parents and relatives of police homicide has called for protests against police brutality, repression, and, quote, the criminalization of a generation. The protests are set to take place in cities across the country. We turn right now to Carl Dix, who is the National Coordination Committee spokesperson for the October 22nd Coalition to Stop Police Brutality. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Carl.
Thank you for having me on today.
Can you tell us about this day around the country?
Well, this day is the day for people who have had it up to here with police having a virtual green light to brutalize and murder people, who've had it with district attorneys who refuse to indict brutal murdering cops, who've had it with judges who refuse to convict, and who've had it with politicians like Mayor Giuliani, who cheerleads for brutal murdering cops and says no matter how egregious the crimes they carry out, they should be given the benefit of the doubt. It's a day when in dozens of cities across the country, and at our latest count, there are going to be events in over 50 cities, and we expect to hear about more as the day wears on. There are going to be people taking to the streets, family members of police murder victims, youth who are tired of being criminalized, allies from many different sections of society, and all saying very loudly in our collective voice, police brutality must stop.
Stolen Lives is the name now of a book that you have compiled. Explain what's in it.
What's in it is over 2,000 cases of people who were killed by police or other law enforcement agents, jail guards, immigration service across the United States just in the 1990s. This information was collected by the October 22nd Coalition, the Anthony Baez Foundation, and the National Lawyers Guild completely on a grassroots basis. No government authority at any level contributed any information to this. We collected this information because they always tell us when the police are caught killing someone that it's an isolated incident or it's justifiable homicide. Well, 2,000 cases in the 1990s ain't isolated incidents. And when you look at the young people, because it's mostly youth who are being killed by the police, 80% of these 2,000 victims are people of color. Most were unarmed and most were not involved in any criminal activity when they were killed. This cannot be justifiable homicide. We've got a nationwide epidemic on our hands, and what we tried to do in the October 22nd Coalition is to document that reality so that the victims know that they're not alone and so that people who are kept in the dark about it are brought into the light. Now, this year on October 22nd, we have two important themes. One is we're going to represent these 2,000 stolen lives in the streets, in the protests and rallies. The second is that we're going to express our outrage at the attempts to murder Mumia Abu-Jamal. And with the death warrant still hanging over him in this case, we think it's very important that we bring that out and put it forward.
Carl, if people want to find out about this National Stolen Lives Day around the country, is there a number they can call, and also about this list of 2,000 that you've made into a book?
To find out what's happening in your area or to get a hold of the Stolen Lives book, call 1-888-NO-BRUTALITY. That's 1-888-NO-BRUTALITY. We also got a website. Let's see, the one I can remember, OCT22NewYork@hotmail.com.
That's Oct 22nd,
NY.
Hotmail.com. I want to thank you very much for being with us. Carl Dick, spokesperson for the National Coordination Committee of the October 22nd Coalition.
The license for kid. Ask Sir Paul Condon about the license for kid. You can't ask the Douglas them about the new style baton. And you can't ask Tony Hassan about him dead by neglect.
And as we turn to our first segment today, we take a look at the debate over Afrocentricity. In recent years, the culture wars have raged in the sphere of public education, and the issue is sure to come up in the presidential and congressional races this fall. One of the most controversial elements of this debate is multicultural education. Some predominantly African-American urban schools have begun to incorporate what's called Afrocentricity into their curricula in an attempt to provide students with an educational experience that better reflects their culture. Afrocentricity is a term coined by Temple University professor Malefe Asante. Asante believes the educational system in the United States promotes white supremacy because it focuses primarily on the achievement of white men in American history and examines and reveres only the contributions of white Europeans over the centuries. In contrast, Afrocentric education draws on the history and philosophy of African cultures in the diaspora. Asante's ideas have been extremely controversial, in part because they question some of the fundamental assumptions that guide education in this country. We now turn to an excerpt of a speech given by the Temple University professor, Malefe Asante.
Afrocentricity is a very simple idea. Anybody can understand it. I work in Philadelphia. In the North Philadelphia, I walk right on the street, ask any brother, they know, they understand. There's no problem. Only problem you have sometimes with people in universities, or sometimes you have it with people in the media. But everybody, it's a very clear idea. Here's what it is, very simple. That whenever you talk about African people, you have to talk about African people as subjects. Don't talk about African people simply as marginals or appendages to the European experience. That's all it is. It's a fundamental idea. And that's why it's such a powerful idea. Everybody says, yeah, that's fine. That African people must be central to our own history and our own reality. Nobody else. You can't have a view of African people that peripheralizes African people, that marginalizes us, that sees the big record or the big picture only as a European picture and a European record and African somewhere dangling on the side. No. Afrocentricity says the African is a subject of human history, not an object. That if you're going to study about African people, you must allow African people to be central in our own history. You must allow us to give what we have, but you can't impose Europe on us. Now, what does this mean in a practical sense? In a practical sense, take any situation. In a practical sense, I'll give you a couple of examples. If you look at what happened in Africa, in a place like Zimbabwe and Zambia, they have over there a waterfall that's the most incredible waterfalls in the world. It is a mile long, three times the height of Niagara. It is called by the Africans Musiwatunya, the smoke that thunders. When David Livingstone went over there, he looked at it and said, this is great waterfalls. I'm going to name it Victoria Falls after the Queen. Now, if you are an African and you've taken him to see this waterfall, and for thousands of years your people have been calling it Musiwatunya, and then all of a sudden he says it's Victoria Falls, and then you start saying it's Victoria Falls, you are decentered. You are destabilized. You're on the way to becoming Clarence Sides. You will be crazy before you know it. That's the process. Understand that it is a very clear process of what has happened to African people in the Americas. When we left Africa, and you know this, we did not leave Africa as slaves. No African slaves were brought to the Americas, not one. African people were brought to the Americas. And the African people who were brought to the Americas were blacksmiths, they were potters, weavers, they were miners, they were diplomats, they were people who were fishermen and fisherwomen, they were farmers, they were military leaders and soldiers, they were members of royal families, they were craftsmen and artisans. African people were brought to America and enslaved in America. No African slaves were brought here. You can only understand that. You can only understand that if you take an Afrocentric point of view. Because if you don't take an Afrocentric point of view, then you don't understand it. You believe that somehow Africans as were brought here because you have a peripheral view of African people. But African people who came to America were not a great pool of people waiting on the shores of Africa to be plucked off and brought over here. And I know, I mean, this sounds funny to some of y'all, because a lot of people still think that we're not Africans. They think that there is some magic in the salt water. That when you know, it's saline consciousness. You know, that somehow when you cross the salt water, you can leave Africa as an African. But when you land over here, something happens. You magically, you're no longer an African. You know what the Senegalese say. The Wolof wood may remain in water for 10 years, but it will never become a crocodile. And you got to think about that. And this is why my great-grandmother in Georgia, when I was a young boy, she used to say to us, it seemed to her that the more educated Africans got, the more knowledge we got, it seemed to her that the crazier we became. And I couldn't understand that at first. I thought my great-grandmother was anti-intellectual until I grew up and started watching, you know, checking it out. Look at it. In most cases, when people are educated, they learn, the more they learn, the deeper they get into their history and their culture, the more knowledgeable they are, the more cultured they become. What is it to be a cultured African? How am I cultured? I am cultured because I understand all of the nuances of my history and culture. I have mastered the rhythms of my people, the poetry of my people. That's why I'm educated, I'm cultured. But the African, the more education we get, sometimes the further away we are from our people. We can't even talk to each other anymore. You know what I'm saying? That's strange. No other people do you find that kind of problem. But of course, I understand why we have it. Because when we left the continent of Africa and we landed here, we had come through an incredible ordeal that we like to forget, which we cannot forget.
That's really fine.
You should never forget it. In fact, in a book which I don't have here, which I have written called The Historical and Cultural Atlas of African Americans, which you can find almost in any bookstore, in that book I have tried to deal with the dreaded Middle Passage. Because, you know, we forget it. Our children don't even know it.
That's right.
Look, you know how long it would take a ship to come from Africa to here? 35 days, sometimes 80 days if the weather was bad. Do you know how much space Africans had on those ships? 18 inches between one African and the next level. Because they were, the ships were in terms of the levels, you see. People were stacked in the ships. Did you not know that the men were always chained? And that men and women were naked on that ship, on those ships? Did you not know that on those ships they had no electric light? They were not luxury liners. You know, sometimes those of us who go to Kemet, we go and we take the cruise up the Nile on a nice ship. No, no, it was not that kind of ship. These were no luxury liners. No electric light. No toilet facilities. And when people would be packed in these ships so tightly, they could hardly breathe. And many would die. And when a person would die, somebody next to him would say, gone he to his own country, or gone she to her own friends. They felt so deeply about what was happening. This was a middle passage. In the case of a storm, when the ship was being tossed about on the ocean, many people just simply died straight away. And then there was always those defiant ones. And there are records of them. The slave captains wrote in their journals of the defiance of women and men. Some who would throw their children overboard to keep them from going into bondage and slavery. Some who, because of their history in their own land and in their own country, could not abide the notion of servitude to anybody. I mean, this is why in the Amistad incident, we have the revolt of the Africans on the high seas, because it was a dreaded middle passage. When people got to this side, they were so happy, because they did not believe that anything could be as horrible as the middle passage. And yet, when they stepped off those boats, they didn't even know what was waiting for. It was going to be something much more horrible. But that journey, that 35 to 80 day journey from the continent of Africa across the ocean, was such a psychological transforming experience for most Africans that it literally shook up the psychological system of African people. But when we got off the boat, then the first thing they said was, they off the boat, but they still not slaves yet. How are we going to make them slaves? They had what they call a period of breaking, the seasoning period, in which they would take an African. An African would step off the boat, and she would say, "My name is Tobolayefa." You know, great name. Out of the Ijo people of Nigeria. And they would say, "I'm gonna call you Betty." Brother gets off the boat, said, "My name is Obadike." "You're gonna be called Bill." How do you decenter somebody? You know, it's a very simple process. How do you take somebody who is mature, who is rooted, who is grounded, who has values, who understands the historical experiences of his or her people, and then you reduce them to a slave? How do you do that? They say, "I speak five languages." And you say, "No, you don't speak languages. There are no languages in Africa. You speak dialects." You say, "My nation is Mandingo." And they say, "You don't come from a nation. You come from a tribe." You say, "My religion is Yoruba." So you don't have a religion, you got a cult. So everything, every item, every concept that the African had was stolen and taken from him.
Malefe Kete Asante, professor and chair of African American Studies at Temple University and author of several books, his latest, African Intellectual Heritage, a Book of Sources. You're listening to Democracy Now! Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. A federal court ruled last night that the Ku Klux Klan must be allowed to demonstrate in New York City this weekend, saying the New York mayor, Giuliani, had violated the group's First Amendment rights by refusing to permit the rally if the Klan members wore their masks. At the same time, the court turned down a claim from an anti-Klan group, the Partisan Defense Committee, that police had violated their First Amendment rights by refusing them a permit to hold a counter protest against the Klan march. Meanwhile, FBI reports this week warns police departments around the country of possible racist violence by white supremacist militias as the year 2000 approaches. We continue with Professor Molefe Kete-Asante, who is a professor of Africana Studies at Temple University.
And so, after a while, some people began to believe that they came over here on the Mayflower. That they were part of the pilgrims. That they didn't come over here across the dreaded Middle Passage. That somehow their experience, their attitudes, their ideas were not really African. That somehow they were changed and different. I call that the decentering process. That's why you need Afrocentricity. To get Africans back to a subject position, to a centered place, to an understanding that we are actors in history, not merely the acted upon. Let me explain it another way. When your child and my child sits in the classroom, that child, whatever the class is, there shouldn't be, because there is no subject in the world that is foreign to the African. After all, whether you take archaeology or biology, according to the best science we have, the origin of the human race is on the continent of Africa. So the first people who decided what was edible and what was not had to be African people. The first people who decided what was the best way to cross a river or a stream had to be African people. That was fundamental. But look at this. When our children sit in the classroom, they ought to sit in the classroom not as renters of information, but as owners of information. That information the teacher teaches, that information, that child ought to sit there and know, yeah, mathematics, yeah, that's us. The oldest mathematical instrument in the world today that anybody has ever found, the oldest mathematical instrument, is the Isange bone abacus calculator. You can read about it in a number of places. You can read about it in the book Africa Counts, but you can also read about it in the new book, The Crest of the Peacock, by George Joseph. And what Joseph argues is that it is 28,000 years old. They used to say it was 8,000 years old. He says new evidence says 28,000 years old. No mathematical instrument anywhere in the world as old as this African instrument found in the heart of Africa in Zaire among the Isange people. You say, well, that's just a counter. I mean, that's not really any... theoretical stuff. The oldest books of mathematics in the world are African books. The Rhine Papyrus is one of them, and the Moscow Papyrus is the other one. One is in the British Museum, and the other one's in the Moscow Museum. They're African books of mathematics. The oldest books of mathematics. Where? Geometry. The oldest geometry is African geometry. The oldest human architecture where human beings built something that we know of is also African. So why shouldn't my child sit in a classroom and not feel an owner of information? Why must he or she be made marginal to human knowledge? You know why? Because we live with a white, racist, supremacist educational system.
And it was designed particularly in the 17th century for that purpose. In the University of Göttingen in Germany, in the 1700s, two brothers, Wilhelm von Humboldt and Friedrich von Humboldt, designed a system that they called the hierarchy of races. And they developed the notion of the Aryans at the top. These were the so-called, these were the Germans in their mind. The Alpines, people like the French. And the Mediterraneans, people like the Italians and the Greeks. And they said these were the hierarchy. The highest race was the Aryans, the second highest the Alpines, the next Mediterranean, and the Africans, the Asians, somewhere way by, down below. That system, developed in the 18th century in Germany, became the dominant system and structure of knowledge in America. So when it came to America, I'm sure how it came here. It came here in two ways. First, it came to the graduate school at Johns Hopkins. It was a German system. The guy wrote a book called The Greek Tyranny Over Germany. Well, the Greek tyranny over Germany was the same tyranny I told you about in the introduction to this presentation. And that tyranny was that philosophy was Greek. And so the Germans adopted that, and when they said they were Aryans, their problem was they did not go very far back. If you start asking the question like, what was going on in Germany in 2000 BC? You couldn't get an answer. I mean, actually, they could even get an answer from the Greeks in 2000 BC. So let's bring it down a little lower. What was going on in 600 BC in Germany, right? So they couldn't get an answer. So they began to say, okay, well, we got to find us an antiquity. And their antiquity was to skip over the contemporary Greeks, because they didn't like the contemporary Greeks because they thought they were Mediterraneans. And they went back to the philosophers, Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. They said these were Aryans. And so the Germans connected up to them, leaped over the contemporary Greeks, got the ancient Greeks, and said that's the connection. So this is why people call it the Greek tyranny over Germany. Because what happened was that same thing came to America, and it became the Greek-German tyranny over America. I'm sure how it became the Greek-German tyranny over America. One of the interesting things you've got to understand is that if you take a timeline, 2500 BC, and that's the period when the pyramids were, the 80 great pyramids were finished. They were all up. Africans had already built the 80 great pyramids by 2500 BC. 2,500 years before Jesus Christ, pyramids were up, finished, over, done. Africans done that. Don't even have to think about that anymore, right? You can move on to other things. You know what I'm saying? Now, in 2500 BC, look at this though. In 2500 BC, if you ask somebody, what's going on in Greece? Nothing. But the Africans already built the pyramids. Look at this. If it's not going on in Greece, you know it's not going on anywhere else in Europe. So I don't need to get into Britain or Spain or Norway or anything like that, right? Now, but yet, the question has to be, how then did they turn history on its ears and change the situation? So you start with the Greeks. If the Greeks are not, the Greeks are not even in the picture. The Chinese come in the picture, 2500 BC, with the Xia dynasty of China. The Indians come in with 2200 BC and 1800 BC with the Mohenjo-Daro and the Harappan civilizations. We don't get the Greeks. So don't even talk about the Romans, because they're later. When do we get the Greeks? The first voice out of the Greeks is Homer, 800 BC. That's the first intelligent voice out of the Greeks. Divine muse, speak to me of the riotous wrath of Achilles, Peleus' son, of how he caused 10,000 Greeks to lose their souls and their bodies to be eaten by the birds and the dogs. Begin where they quarreled, proud Achilles and Agamemnon, king of men. That's what Homer, that's the Iliad. He writes that, right? Now, he writes the Iliad, but look at this. When you start investigating, where did he go to school? In Africa, just like all the other Greeks. So the question is, how then is it? And I don't know whether any of you saw about maybe 2 years ago now, a year and a half ago, I was on a Ted Koppel Nightline show. with Dinesh D'Souza. And Ted Koppel said, but Professor Rassanti, what is wrong with studying Homer, Plato, Aristotle, Socrates, and Democritus? I said, and so what is wrong with studying Kulanuk, Keti, Pepe the First, Kagimni? These were philosophers who lived 2,000 years before the ones you have mentioned. And I didn't quite do him like Mandela did him, but he was visibly shaken, you know what I'm saying? Because actually he's operating on false information. See, you can't operate on false information when you're confronted with correct information. And that's the problem. See, they don't know African information. Nobody, they never had to study it. And in fact, they not only didn't have to study it, they assumed that it didn't exist. So what did African scholars do? We went and studied. And now we come back, they can't even argue. There's no argument. It was a beautiful thing to have seen Arthur Schlesinger trying to debate me. It was a beautiful thing. They got a videotape of it. You really should see that. East Stroudsburg University got a videotape of that. Very interesting, because the position is untenable. You cannot hold a position of white supremacy in a multicultural society. Not only is that untenable, you cannot base your argument on some kind of white exclusivity. It cannot exist. And not only that, you can't even base your argument on the fact that the European culture is the oldest, because it is not the oldest culture. So fundamentally, the 244 years in which Africans were enslaved were years in which we were distanced from our culture and which white people wrote new books. And then made a law that says you couldn't read and you couldn't write. That's a 244-year advantage. And that's why I tell young people, right now we should be reading and writing as much as we can. Because, see, we're trying to catch up with that 244 years that they had us enslaved. From can't see in the morning to can't see at night, Africans working for free. Laid the material foundations of this United States of America. If it weren't for the African labor that was free, I believe this country would be a third-rate nation. If they had to pay for all the labor we gained, just think about it. That's why reparations are necessary. You need to think about that. It's a very... Because you can't even redress the problem. You cannot even redress the problem with affirmative action. It can only be redressed when people confront the fact that in order to have a cohesive society, in order to have a progressive country, in order to have a good government here, the people in this society who have been on the bottom, who have been persecuted, whose labor was stolen from them, we've got to make that right. And the only way you can make that right, as I see it, is reparations. I don't see affirmative action would take 1,000 years for it to be correct at the rate that people are going. You know what I'm saying? People don't want affirmative action. You know what I'm saying? They don't even want affirmative action. So when you start talking about anything else, you see the problem, you see. In terms of the African-American population and Afrocentricity, Afrocentricity simply claims that the only chosen people are self-choosing people. You can't be chosen any way else. That's how you get to be a chosen people. And the African-American people of African descent in the United States of America, have often been confused because we have thought that we can somehow distance ourselves from our African origin. You know what I'm saying? Let me put it this way. People say, and I had this happen. I said to a group of students, some of you have heard me say this before because it's true. I had a group of students at Temple. I said to them, all the Italian students, raise your hand. And I had a couple of students raise your hand. I said, all the Vietnamese, raise your hand. I had some students raise your hand. All the Polish students, raise your hand. I had some raise your hand. I said, all the Africans, raise your hand. And nobody raised their hand. This was my class. Mostly African. So I said, bro, why you didn't raise your hand? Yo, man, I'm an American. I said, so is the Vietnamese. So is the Italian. There's no contradiction between your citizenship and your origin, your cultural origin. There's no problem with that. Your nationality is an American, a United Statesian, actually. I mean, because the brothers and sisters in Brazil, they will raise questions with you when you say you are African-American.
They would say, "Well, what do you mean? You have, there's North America, there's South America, you know, people in the Caribbean. I mean, what are you talking about?" But this notion, but that I think goes right in hand with the American notion of this grand concept of taking all the space. You can't take all the space. We don't, and that is what has happened. That's what whites have done. They've taken all space. They say classical music, and they mean white music. They don't mean, there's no other classical music. You don't even, no Japanese classical, no African classical. Not even any American classical, which is jazz. They just say classical meaning European concert music. Bach, you know, Mozart. But whatever, classical dance, they take that over. Take all the space, cover all the territory. Then say, you can be on the fringes. And I said, no, I don't want to be on the fringes. I want to be right in the center. You see? A subject. I don't mind you having your own center. That is correct. It's always correct. That's why I talk about it as polycentric. This society is polycentric. Ought to be. But it cannot be the imposition of a particularism, Eurocentricity, on everybody as if it is the only perspective in reality. Let me just raise one other question, because this comes up a lot of times, and I'll be finished. Eurocentricity and Afrocentricity are not counterparts. In other words, you can't say that Afrocentricity is a black version of Eurocentricity. Let me explain why. Eurocentricity, in its normal capacity, is legitimate. Because people of European background ought to have a perspective on reality that comes with their reference points. I mean, they ought to be able to, their mountains, their concepts, whatever, that's correct. However, Eurocentrism in America has become an ethnocentric view. Now, what is an ethnocentric view? It is when you valorize your particular view, and you make your particular view the only view, and you downgrade everybody else's view. You claim that as Schlesinger claimed, he said, you know, our concept of democracy is what made America great. You know, he just claimed all the territory. I said, you can't claim democracy if we agree that it's a good thing. I said, I challenge you on democracy. Because the founding fathers and James Madison wrote this in the Federalist Papers, number 10. I told him this. He said, we're not for democracy, because democracy is the tyranny of the majority. I said, now you say you claim democracy? This is one of your founding fathers. He says, he's not for it. So where does the democracy come from? I said, look at the Native Americans. And I said, we still don't know what y'all learned from the Africans. Because they didn't write. They didn't want to write about that, you see. But obviously the Africans came from more developed empires. When Africans were brought here, we were coming here from the remnants of Ghana, Mali, and Songhai, the greatest empires in the world at that time. Most organized. Most highly developed educationally. University of San Kore at Timbuktu was the earliest university, modern university, from a continent with the earliest, most ancient university, the university at Luxor, Thebes, at Karnak, the Grand Lodge, Osiraka. So we were coming with all this, we came with all of this. You see what I'm saying? So when you raise questions about space, they can't take all the space. And we always say, what we're trying to do is to show you what the possibilities are. Stony the road we trod, bitter the chastening rod, felt in the days when hope unborn had died. Yet with a steady beat have not our weary feet brought us to the place for which our parents sighed. We have come over a way that with tears have been watered. We have come treading our path through the blood of the slaughtered out of the gloomy past. So now we stand at last, a white gleam of our bright star is cast. Thank you very much.
Professor Malefi Keteasanti, author of African Intellectual Heritage, a Book of Sources, and other books. We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we mentioned in the headlines today, October 22nd is a national day of protest against police brutality, repression, and the criminalization of a generation. All across the country, people are attending vigils, teach-ins, marches, and rallies to protest an epidemic of police brutality throughout the United States. Victims are overwhelmingly African Americans, Latinos, other people of color, as well as poor whites, many of them youths, and had lives, families, and were a part of society, but rarely do we hear of them or the circumstances around their deaths. Cases like the shooting deaths of Taisha Miller in Riverside, California, and Amadou Diallo in New York City have received national attention, but there are thousands of others whose deaths are not publicized, and we never hear about the real circumstances of their killing. The Stolen Lives Project is gathering the names of those killed by the police and the Border Patrol. This project is a part of the Anthony Baez Foundation, the October 22nd Coalition, and the National Lawyers Guild. It's sponsored by the Center for Constitutional Rights. Today we hear a special reading from the Stolen Lives Project of the names of some of those killed by police. Reading the names are poet Jerry Quigley from Los Angeles, actor Mario Van Peebles, and filmmaker Michael Moore, actor Ossie Davis.
Nicholas Haywood, Jr., African-American, was shot and killed on September 29, 1994, by a New York City housing cop while Nicholas was playing with a toy gun. He was 13 years old.
On January 12, 1995, police shot two Puerto Rican youths, Anthony Rosero, 18 years old, and Hilton Vega, 21, while they were lying face down on the floor. Anthony was shot 14 times. Hilton was shot 8 times. The officers were former bodyguards of New York City Mayor Giuliani. No charges were filed.
Mario Miranda, a 26-year-old man from Mexico, was killed on June 12, 1992, in Nogales, Arizona, along the U.S.-Mexico border.
Danette Strawberry Daniels, a 31-year-old African-American woman who was killed on June 7, 1997 by Newark, New Jersey police who claimed they arrested her for dealing drugs and had to shoot her after a scuffle broke out in the squad car. Witnesses say Strawberry, who was pregnant, wasn't buying drugs, and protests erupted on the spot when she was shot dead.
Alicio Santos Carmona, 24 years old, Mexican, died of injuries on January 23, 1996, after he fell off a cliff near the border with Mexico while being chased by immigration agents at night.
Jared Fay Benito, a 16-year-old Filipino, was shot dead on June 7, 1996 in Pearl City, Hawaii.
Jorge Guillan, a 40-year-old man from Honduras, was killed on October 3, 1995 after family members called 911 and Chicago police responded. Jorge was suffering from schizophrenic hallucinations and holding a 2x4 to keep the door shut. Police threw him to the floor, beat his head with a flashlight, and handcuffed him. One cop stepped on the back of Jorge's neck. He died of asphyxiation, face down, in a pool of his own blood.
Aaron Williams, African-American, was killed on June 4, 1995 in San Francisco when police asked him to come outside his home for questioning about a burglary. When he did, police swarmed him, ramming his head into a wall. 12 cops brought him to the ground, hogtied, beat him, and pepper sprayed him. One cop kicked him so hard it left a boot print. A surgical mask was placed over his nose and mouth to keep the pepper spray in. He was thrown into the back of a police van and left in the police station's parking lot where he died.
Corey CeeLo Footman was 19 years old when he was drowned on April 8, 1997, after Miami-Dade police chased him into Snake Creek Canal at Buccaneer Park in Miami, Florida.
On August 9, 1997, Abner Louima, a Haitian immigrant, was arrested outside the Rendezvous Club in Brooklyn, New York. He was beaten in the squad car with fists and police radios. At the station house, he was raped with a bathroom plunger that was then forced into his mouth. The officer who did this reportedly bragged that he had to break a man.
Angelo Castro Jr., Puerto Rican, was beaten, abused with racial insults, and told by Chicago police he'd be killed if he didn't move away. His family moved. Angel returned to the neighborhood for a friend's birthday party. After leaving the party, a police car rammed him as he rode his bike. As Angel tried to get up, police shot and killed him. He was 15 years old.
Eric Shaw, a 31-year-old white man, was shot and killed in Iowa City on August 21, 1996, when police entered his art studio unannounced and opened fire. Police later said they were looking for a suspected burglar.
Reginald Jermaine Canty of Spartanburg, South Carolina, was 22 years old when he was shot dead after he and five friends were out in the country and fired some shots in the air.
Mark Garcia, a 41-year-old Latino man, was killed in San Francisco on April 6, 1996. He'd been robbed and was wandering the streets when police came upon him. They beat and pepper sprayed him, threw him to the ground, grinding a foot into his back. Mark was thrown into a police van and handcuffed. He had a massive heart attack and died the next day.
On May 20th, 1997, U.S. Marines patrolling the border with Mexico shot and killed Ezequiel Hernandez Jr., an 18-year-old Chicano, while he was out herding his family's goats.
On August 10, 1997, Leon Fisher, a 23-year-old African-American, was killed by Nashville police who shot him while handcuffed.
John Pava, a 37-year-old man, was killed on April 4, 1992, in Reno, Nevada, after three officers came to his house for routine questioning about a disagreement with a neighbor.
Eric Smith, 22-year-old African-American, was killed in Chicago on April 9, 1996. Eric, who was deaf, was attempting to communicate with police with sign language when they beat him with metal batons and shot him six times.
August 20th, 1989, Luis Hernandez, a 14-year-old Mexican youth, was struck and killed by a Border Patrol four-wheel drive vehicle as he was running back toward Mexico after trying to cross the border. 3 days later, 22-year-old Anna Ponce was killed in a high-speed chase with Border Patrol agents. 5 days later, 15-year-old Pedro Hernandez was shot and wounded by a Border Patrol agent after Pedro came to the rescue of another immigrant being assaulted by an INS agent.
Catherine Thompson, 39 years old, was found dead on October 29, 1995, in a Seattle County jail hanging by her shoelaces after an earlier struggle with the police.
Andre Jones, a young African-American, was killed on August 22, 1992, in the Simpson County Jail in Simpson County, Mississippi.
Anthony Baez, a 29-year-old Puerto Rican man, was killed on December 22, 1994, when New York City police officer Francis Lavoti put him in an illegal chokehold after a football struck Lavoti's patrol car. Lavoti was found not guilty.
James Johnson was killed in 1995 in Detroit when an off-duty officer shot him to death, claiming he mistook a handheld VCR remote control unit in James's pocket for a gun.
Kenneth B. Fennell was shot dead on August 30, 1993 by a North Carolina State Highway Patrol trooper.
Edward A. Anderson, a 28-year-old African-American, was shot and killed on January 15, 1996 by Seattle police. Edward was shot in the throat from 18 inches away while stuck hanging on a fence outside his wife's house. His hands were raised, he was not wearing a shirt, and he was unarmed.
Johnny Gamage, 31-year-old African-American, was killed in 1995 when white police officers in Pittsburgh pulled his car over for allegedly driving erratically and beat and choked him to death.
Ernest Sayon, a 22-year-old African-American, was killed on April 29, 1994, when police in Staten Island, New York, put him in a chokehold, even though Sayon was already in handcuffs.
Erdman Bascom, a 42-year-old black man, was killed on February 17, 1988, in the state of Washington, when a police officer knocked down his door without warning in a drug raid at 4 a.m.
On May 13, 1985, 11 members of the MOVE organization, Conrad, Teresa, Raymond, Rhonda, Frank, Tommaso, Katricia, Zanetta, Delicia, Phil Africa, and Vincent Liepart, were killed after a day-long siege by Philadelphia police who dropped a bomb on the MOVE house and burned it and 63 other homes in a black community to the ground.
Tyron Lewis, an 18-year-old African-American, was shot to death in St. Petersburg, Florida, by police on October 24, 1996, after Tyron was pulled over for a traffic stop.
Quan Chung Cao, a 33-year-old Chinese man, was shot and killed by police in Ronald Park because he was shouting and waving a broomstick, which police says was done in a martial arts manner.
Bernard Solomon, age 19, African-American, died on January 13, 1997. After years of police harassment, Bernard was told by Chicago police that they would kill him. A few days later, he was arrested. He was found hung in his cell. Police claim he hung himself with his shirt. But when his body was examined by family members, they found Bernard was still wearing his shirt on one arm.
Adolph Boyd Jr., a 30-year-old African-American, was killed on April 14, 1997, by Cleveland police. Police shot him at least 12 times in the back as he was walking toward a Wendy's, although police said he was brandishing a gun. None was ever produced.
James Corliss, a 22-year-old African-American, was shot dead on August 9, 1997, in Baltimore, Maryland, after four police officers had surrounded him in a public marketplace.
As one Keyshawn Watson, a 23-year-old African-American, was killed on June 13, 1996, when police in Brooklyn shot at Keyshawn 24 times. 18 bullets hit Keyshawn while he sat in his car with his hands in the air.
Santiago Lopez, a 17-year-old Latino, was shot by L.A. County Sheriff's deputies in 1995. Santiago had been playing basketball. He had a cigarette lighter that resembled a gun. The deputies arrived and shot Santiago. When he fell to the ground, a deputy came up and fired two shots to Santiago's head. Santiago was unarmed.
Joseph N. Cooper, Jr., a 21-year-old African-American, was shot dead on November 11, 1995, near Robert F. Kennedy Memorial Stadium in Washington, D.C., by an off-duty police officer.
Gerald Hall, a 19-year-old African-American, was killed on November 15, 1992, by a San Francisco Bay Area transit officer who accused him of stealing a Walkman. The officer struck Gerald with the barrel of his shotgun and shot him in the back of the head.
Leonard Acorn Peters, Native American, was gunned down by sheriffs in an ambush on a rural Indian land on April 14, 1995.
Edward Mallett, a 25-year-old African-American, was killed in 1994 in Phoenix. A double amputee, Edward was killed after being placed in a chokehold by police who claimed he was resisting arrest.
Alicia Soltero Vasquez and Enrique Flores, Mexican, survived a TV videotape brutal beating on April 2, 1996, after a truck full of Mexican immigrants was chased by immigrant agents and Riverside County sheriffs.
Yang Xin Wang, a 16-year-old Chinese youth, was killed on March 24, 1995 in Brooklyn, New York, when this ninth grade honor student was shot in the head by police, who also threw him into a glass door.
Tony Gutierrez, a 14-year-old Latino, killed by LAPD on July 29, 1995, when police claimed he pointed a semi-automatic weapon at them. A semi-automatic weapon was found 15 feet away from Tony, on the other side of a fence. Witnesses say Tony was unarmed when shot.
Caroline Sissy Adams, an African-American woman, was shot to death by a white police officer on September 10, 1996 in New Brunswick, New Jersey, after she was questioned about alleged prostitution.
Kevin Cedeno, a 16-year-old youth from Trinidad, was shot dead on April 6, 1997, in Washington Heights, New York, by police who claimed Kevin went at them with a machete. An autopsy report revealed that Kevin had been shot in the back.
Malik Jones was killed on April 14, 1997, by an East Haven, Connecticut police officer who followed Malik in his car. When Malik's car was boxed in by police, the police broke the window of Malik's car and shot him in the head repeatedly. He was 21 years old.
Douglas Fisher, a 25-year-old African-American, was choked to death on July 20th, 1995, by two Best Buy store security guards. While Douglas was on the ground, hands behind his back, and spitting up blood.
Douglas Fisher is the son of Errol Maitland, our technical director. And that does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Errol Maitland is our technical director. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
Is as important as the killing of white men. White mother sons, we who believe in freedom and not freedom and not rest. We who believe in freedom, freedom, freedom cannot rest. That which touches me most is that I had a chance to work with people, passing on to others that which was passed on to me. We who believe in freedom and that freedom cannot rest.
Sing it with us, come on.
We who believe in freedom and that freedom cannot. To me, young people come first.
They come first.
They have the courage where we fail. And if I can but shed some light as they carry us through the gate.